Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241, and it's February 25th, and there's no SI Tuesday coming up. Okay, and we're going to finish cell respiration and move on to nervous system. I do want to write some things on the board really quick, just so that you can tie some of these metabolic pathways together. All right, but you might want to refer to this slide right here. So I guess the first question would be, what's the whole point of cellular respiration? You know that water is produced, oxygen is consumed, CO2 is produced. But what's the whole point of cellular respiration? ATP synthesis. Okay, I think that's as low as I can get the microphone right there. So let's see if I can get to the board without it feeding back too much. All right, so what's the energy molecule to cellular respiration, at least the one that we've looked at? It's glucose, right? And there are four main metabolic pathways. What are the four main metabolic pathways? All right, so I'm just going to make a really small column right here. The first one is, don't forget, glucose goes in. What happens to glucose? Yeah, so the first one is glycolysis. Let me make sure that I can erase this thing. Oh, good. Okay. Glycolysis. All right, what's the next reaction? Okay, we're going to call it the preparatory reaction. Preparatory reaction. Preparatory reaction to what? Krebs cycle. All right, so that's the third one. All right, and the fourth one is going to be electron transport chain, ETC. Okay, so those are the four main reactions that you should have somehow organized in your mind and know what the inputs are, what the energy outputs are, where they take place in the cell, which require oxygen, which don't, that kind of stuff. So let's just write this on the board really fast. So we start with glucose up over here, and what's the end product? I'll write it down way over here someplace. All right, the end product is water. Okay, so let's see how we get from glucose to water. Now, why did I write glucose way up over here and water way, way down over here? Because the vertical position on the board is going to represent free energy change. All right, so if you have a reaction that starts with a high free energy and ends up with a low free energy, what kind of reaction is that in terms of thermodynamics? Is that endergonic or exorganic?
Exergonic.
Yeah, it's exorganic. So it's going to be releasing energy, right? Starting with a big molecule, ending up with smaller molecules, that's going to release energy. And what can your body do with that free energy that's being released? It can make ATP. It can drive an endergonic reaction, namely the synthesis of ATP from ADP and inorganic phosphate. All right, so glucose goes to pyruvate. All right, so is that glycolysis?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely right. All right, now we said that the whole point of respiration is to make ATP. Do you get any ATP out of that? And how much? How to think of it? Yeah, you get 2 ATP. What kind of phosphorylation takes place when you get those 2 ATPs? Yeah, remember, what are the two kinds of phosphorylation steps? Substrate level versus oxidative phosphorylation. Substrate level phosphorylation versus oxidative phosphorylation. So you get 2 ATPs, but what else do you get from glycolysis? Yeah, you get some NADH. How many NADHs? I forgot. Are you sure about 2? Okay. So 2 NADHs, and NADH is what, a cofactor or a coenzyme? Coenzyme. It's carrying something from one set of reactions to another. What is it carrying?
Hydrogen.
Okay, yeah, your book makes a point out of hydrogen ions, but I really would like for you to think in terms of electrons, high-energy electrons. All right, so high-energy electrons. So when these NADH go into the mitochondria, what do they produce? How many ATPs? Normally, you're going to say 3 ATPs for every NADH, but where does glycolysis take place?
Yeah. Cytosol.
All right. And so when you have NADH in the cytosol, it gets converted into FADH2 to get into the mitochondria. So you lose some energy from it. So you only get 2 ATP from these NADHs in the cytosol. So you get what? 4 ATP. So let's just do the conversion right away. All right. So that's the first step. Second step, pyruvate going to acetyl coenzyme A. Acetyl CoA. All right. So there's a deep carboxylation reaction that happens right here, right? So besides that, we get some what? CO2 out of this. Now, where does this happen? There's a big change in the machinery right here. It goes inside of mitochondria, right? So that dotted line represents going in the mitochondria. Under what conditions can pyruvate enter the mitochondria? Yeah, under aerobic conditions, right? All right, glycolysis can happen under aerobic or anaerobic conditions. And how many carbon atoms are in this acetyl group? Ah, there's 3 in pyruvate. This is for sure. But when it's decarboxylated to give you acetyl coenzyme A, you lose one of those carbon atoms. So really, how many are in there? 3 minus 1 or 2, right? So there's 2 carbons in there. So this is reaction number 1. Here's reaction number 2. And then what's reaction number 3? Acetyl coenzyme A donates those 2 carbons into the Krebs cycle. That's right. So here's Krebs. All right. So what happens with the Krebs? You get some, you've got to get rid of a couple of carbon dioxides, right, in the Krebs cycle. But what else do you get? Let's put it maybe nice on the side over here. You get any ATPs? Yeah, you do, right? How many ATPs for every glucose? Yeah, because the cycle goes around how many times for every glucose? Twice, so you get 2 ATP. And what kind of phosphorylation is that? What kind of phosphorylation is making that ATP? Substrate level or oxidative phosphorylation? That's still substrate level phosphorylation, even though all of these processes require oxygen. And we've seen why that is already. But 2, because it goes around twice. And then what about other important energy molecules? Anything else produced by Krebs?
NADH.
Ah, NADH. How many NADH? Yeah, you get 3 for every turn times 2, so you get 6. And what's another one? FADH2. And you get 2 of those. All right, now this NADH is inside the mitochondria, so we don't waste any energy getting it into the mitochondria. They're already there. So we got 2 ATP. How many ATPs do we get from this NADH right here? So would you say 3, right? 3 times 6, 18. How'd I do? So far, so good. And what about how many ATPs for FADH2 right here?
4.
Yeah, we just multiply it by 2, right? So that's going to produce 4 ATPs. All right, 4 ATPs. So if we add up all the ATPs right now, what do we got? We got 6, 7, 8, right? 26, 30. What did I miss? Did I count wrong? All right, I'll have to figure that out, where I went wrong. All right, now how do we get, but let me finish my thought right here. How do we get ATPs from these NADHs and FADH2s? Where do they go? Into the fourth reaction right here. Right, so these NADHs come in over here. So do these. So do these. And that goes into ETC. And what kind of reactions are characterized by the electron transport chain? Oxidative, right? Reduction reactions. And remember, you got to know something about the structure of the mitochondria that's pumping protons from the matrix into the intermembrane space, and then those protons flow back into the matrix via ATP synthase, and that's what generates those ATP. Yeah. Oh, here we go. Nice. Nice, nice, nice. Exactly right. Okay. Yeah, I remembered, but then I forgot to write it down. All right, so here we get, for every glucose, we get what? Two NADH is right here. And what does that turn into? That turns into another six, so that's 36 ATP. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so when I pointed that slide out to you the very first time, right, it just takes a number of days to put all the pieces together for you to understand. I think now you're probably at a point to where you can go back and actually start to study that particular chapter and have it make some sense. But it takes a while to talk about all those different steps. All right, so that's kind of the level that I want you to know. I don't want you to know the names of all the enzymes and all of the intermediates. All right, but I think something that's really important to know is how many carbons are in glucose? Six. How many carbons in pyruvate? Three. Okay. And then how many carbons in acetate? Two. Okay. There's something else that's pretty important. And that is, glucose can run in the reverse direction. Right? So if you have a three-carbon molecule, whether it's pyruvate or glycerol or whatever, it's relatively easy for your body to make glucose out of it. What do we call that process? Gluconeogenesis. Now what is an impossible process is to take a two-carbon unit and make new glucose out of it. So going from this two-carbon unit back to pyruvate or whatever is an impossibility in our bodies. The other thing that I want to mention right now is that all of these intermediates of the Krebs cycle are sugar-based molecules. So that you need to have some sugar in your diet, okay, to get energy from other sugars that you have, but more importantly, we're going to look at fat metabolism in just a little bit. So in order for you to metabolize fats to get energy, you do need to have some sugar molecules because those are necessary intermediates for the Krebs cycle. All right, so just kind of file that in your memory for just a little bit. All right, so what else can I layer on here? Where does CO2 come from? What metabolic pathways that we have to exhale out of our body? Where does CO2 come from? Which one of these four pathways, and where is it located at? The prep reaction produces some CO2 that we exhale. And where does that CO2 come from? What organelle? Mitochondria. Okay. Where are the other CO2s? Where are more CO2s produced? Krebs cycle, located in the mitochondria as well. Under what kind of conditions? Under aerobic conditions. So the other thing I think you should realize is that under anaerobic conditions, what happens to pyruvate because it can't get inside the mitochondria? Yeah, it goes into the lactic acid pathway. All right, so that reduces the level of pyruvic acid. All right, that also replenishes what? Something else that's necessary for glycolysis. That replenishes NAD plus, so that maintains glycolysis in the forward direction, so at least you can get some ATP from that anaerobic process. Then one of the last things that we looked at last time is that this lactic acid can leave an exercising muscle cell, go to the liver, and the liver can do what? Can go and make some more glucose out of it, but it's going to require some energy from the liver to do that, right? But the liver doesn't exercise like a muscle, so the liver has energy to make glucose out of it, and then the liver can secrete that glucose back into the blood because it has that glucose 6-phosphatase, and that then glucose can go back to the exercising muscle, and that muscle can make some more ATP out of it, right? What was that cycle called? Where muscle and liver cells interact with each other, muscle cells producing lactic acid, liver cells producing from that lactic acid glucose, and that glucose goes back to those muscle cells. What do we call that cycle? That's the Cori cycle. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much everything that we have been talking about so far. All right, yeah, thanks for that clarification on the prep reaction. Okay. So, now's a really good time for me to field some questions. Do you have a good feeling for oxidative phosphorylation versus substrate level phosphorylation? Okay. All right, so some of you might have to see me, all right, during office hours or something. All right, the only other complication that I can envision right here is the standard way that I am thinking about this chapter compared to how the book writes it, all right? And so don't forget, in my way of thinking, I'm thinking about ATP synthesis from ideal theoretical maximum limits from NADH and FADH2. So the way that I think, how many ATPs can be produced from one NADH inside a mitochondria? It's three, right? And your book is a little bit more pragmatic, more a little bit more real world, and it derates the number of ATPs from three down to 2.5. All right, so when you read the textbook, you don't be too confused by that. Okay, because I'm discussing it under, what, just the theoretical maximum yield of ATP. So I'm not going to test you on any of those real-world practical considerations. All right, so not only can glucose be used to make ATP through cellular respiration, but other energy molecules can under certain circumstances. And fats and proteins can be used to make ATP as well. Oh, let me start the slideshow here. All right, so let's just talk a little bit about some of these other energy molecules. All right, so we have a triglyceride. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Glycerol and three fatty acids, right? And glycerol is a molecule that's very similar to pyruvate, so that when you have a triglyceride and it's hydrolyzed, right? Remember what kind of reaction that is? Hydrolysis reaction is a catabolic reaction. Of course, it releases energy and it requires some water. Water is broken down as well. You get fatty acids and glycerol. Glycerol can be converted into pyruvate, which then can be put together with another glycerol molecule to make glucose, right? So that's a pretty handy molecule. Or glycerol can enter the Krebs cycle if it's decarboxylated in this reaction here. So glycerol can be used to make ATP very efficiently. All right, now what about those triglycerides? The fatty acids. What does a fatty acid look like? It's got what, a CH3, and then a C, and then another C, and depending on whether it's saturated or unsaturated, you have different protons on either side of these carbon atoms, but it's just what, a really long chain hydrocarbon, and then you have a terminal carboxyl group right here. All right, so that's just basically a fatty acid with maybe 10 or 18 carbons long. It's a very, very long chain. And there is energy in those carbon-carbon bonds as well. A fatty acid can be broken down. Maybe I'll put just another carbon right in here, like this. A fatty acid can be broken down, and those carbon molecules can be given to the Krebs cycle to produce what? Some ATP and a lot of NADH and FADH2. But the way a fatty acid is broken down is by two carbon fragments. That's a hot spot right there. Just two carbon fragments at a time. All right, and what do we call a two carbon fragment? That acetyl group. All right, so a fatty acid can be broken down two carbon fragments at a time, bound to coenzyme A, and then coenzyme A can donate those two carbon fragments to the Krebs cycle over here to generate a lot of energy, a lot of useful energy for the cell, namely ATP. So let's see So fatty acids need to go through the Krebs cycle to generate ATP. Proteins. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. Okay, so there is an amino group on an amino acid. And if you have an amino acid, it's deaminated. And then you're left with a hydrocarbon chain, which again can be donated to the Krebs cycle. And so the Krebs cycle is going to turn and produce ATP from amino acids as well. As long as we have the necessary intermediates for the Krebs cycle. What did I say the intermediates for the Krebs cycle are? I want to write that down. Sugars. All right, so I want to just say these are all what? Basically sugar-based molecules. Okay, so fatty acids can go through Krebs cycle as long as these intermediates are here. You need to have some sugars in your diet to metabolize fatty acids and even amino acids to make these ATPs right here. All right, so let me see what I got on the next slide. All right, so here we see a fat. Here we've got glycogen. Glycogen can be converted into glucose, right? Remember, what's the building block of glycogen? It's basically just glucose. So how do you get from glycogen to glucose? What's that process? I see this dotted line right here. Glycogen, what's the word? Genesis or lysis? Lysis, yeah. Glycogenolysis, right? That makes glucose. And of course, glucose can run through glycolysis to make pyruvic acid right here. So here we have a triglyceride. The building blocks of a triglyceride are what? Glycerol and three fatty acids, right? Glycerol can enter the pathway, either the glycolysis pathway, or what's the reverse of glycolysis? Gluconeogenesis, depending on the energy needs of the cell. Okay, and these fatty acids, right, the way that they are metabolized, how are fatty acids metabolized? Not as a three-carbon fragment, but as a how many carbon fragment right here? A two-carbon fragment. All right, so that acetyl-CoA then can donate that acetyl group to the Krebs cycle to generate a lot of ATP. Now, most of these steps, notice that we see a two-way arrow right here. That means that these compounds can be interconverted, right? Glycogen can be interconverted with glucose-1-phosphate or the reverse. But there is one important reaction in this diagram right here where you see a one-way street, just a one-way arrow. Where is that? Yeah, pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA. Because what is the step that's happening right here? And this is an irreversible step. Right? Plants can do this, but we can't do this very well. But going from pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA, there's a decarboxylation reaction. All right? And what's not possible for us is to take a CO2 molecule and have it join another hydrocarbon to make a three-carbon atom. All right, so plants can do that kind of stuff. They can fix carbon dioxide, but we can't do that. So once you have a molecule in a two-carbon fragment, it's only fate, right, like this acetyl-CoA, it only has two possible fates. It can be used to make fats in the body, or it can be metabolized to make energy. Those are the only two possible fates. A two-carbon fragment cannot be used to make sugar, and a two-carbon fragment can't be used to make a protein. That's just not a possibility in our bodies. So that kind of underscores the importance of having some sugars available to cells and have the cells actually be able to import that sugar. All right, so maybe somebody is a diabetic and sugar can't get into those cells. So what's going to happen to the Krebs cycle when somebody's a diabetic? It's going to shut down, all right, because those sugar intermediates are no longer available to run that kind of metabolism for those cells. All right, so that's really one of the sad things about diabetes is that cells are starving to death even though glucose is just right on the other side of the plasma membrane. Okay. All right, the other thing that means is that diabetics can't even metabolize fat for energy, because the Krebs cycle intermediates are being depleted as well. Let me just see what the next slide looks like. Okay. All right, maybe I'll talk about another condition. I know some people maybe need to control their weight or want to control their weight, and they can go on a special diet that helps them lose a lot of triglycerides and fatty acids very efficiently and very quickly. Does anybody know what kind of diet that is? Okay, like the Atkins diet. I don't know if they still call it the Atkins diet anymore, but it's what, a low-sugar diet. It's a high-protein, high-fat diet. And so what happens to somebody that's on their that kind of diet? They actually run out of Krebs cycle intermediates because they have no sugar in their diet. And so what does their body try to do to make ATP? Right? Breaks down lipids, right? And those lipids then get converted into glycerol and fatty acids. But without the Krebs cycle, look at these fatty acids right here. They have no place to go. They can't be used to make sugar. They can't enter the Krebs cycle. And basically, these get broken down, and they produce intermediates that you just breathe out of your body. They're called ketone bodies. Two acetyl groups form a four-carbon molecule, right, a C4 molecule. And you can just breathe those out of your body or actually excrete them in urine. So that's a pretty efficient way of getting rid of excess fat in the body. You don't have to exercise it off. You can just do what? Just breathe it right out of your body. But what is that condition like? What did we say? What other condition, right, also depletes these Krebs cycle intermediates right here? Yeah, diabetes. So the Atkins diet is like what kind of condition almost? It's like diabetes. All right, so you have to be really careful when you're on some of these really fancy diets and be in contact with your physician because your energy metabolism is going to suffer. And I've known people on an Atkins diet and they're so depleted of ATP that their brain really isn't functioning. They lose a lot of cognition. They start to drive on the left-hand side of the street or not pay attention to stoplights. Right, because why? Their brain is just depleted of ATP. So you got to be really careful. Yeah.
You're talking about diabetic
in
the Krebs cycle.
Uh-huh. Is that
for a diabetic that's out of control, or for all diabetic?
Oh, that's uncontrolled diabetes. Okay, and to some extent, maybe even for controlled diabetics. There still are some disease processes in certain cells that take place even though it is controlled. Okay. But I think for this class, I might say diabetes, uncontrolled. And that's why it is so important to control diabetes. Okay, because we don't want these cells starving to death.
Is that why in diabetics, they end up with kidney failure so often and things like this?
Well, a diabetic will suffer. All the tissues that are most susceptible to damage in a diabetic are the ones that are metabolically very active, the ones that need a lot of energy, like kidney, brain, heart, okay, and retina, for instance. And so these are where the symptoms of running out of energy really occur first. Okay, that's why blindness is very prevalent, vascular disease, kidney disease. And there's also a lot of heart and brain disease as well. Okay. Okay. So I just wanted to show you that this two-carbon fragment is a nice branch point for a lot of metabolism inside the cell. But what it can't ever produce are proteins and carbohydrates. Right? It can make other lipids. Right, but and maybe these ketone bodies, like acetone, for instance, which you can just breathe right out of your body. But there are consequences to that. Okay, so this acetyl-CoA can be used to make fatty acids, right? Not only are fatty acids broken down into acetyl-CoA, but acetyl-CoA can make fatty acids, right? Three fatty acids and then glycerol to make a triglyceride. This happens in adipose tissue and in liver tissue. And fat is the major form of energy storage in the body because fat has a very high density of energy, 9 kilocalories per gram, and carbohydrates are less than half of that, right? They're 4 kilocalories per gram. So storing energy in the form of fat is very, very efficient in the body. The only trouble is that if you take a sugar and make a fat out of it, right, you can never take that fat and convert it back into a sugar or a protein again. right? It's trapped as being fat, and the only fate for fat is to, what, under normal circumstances, is to burn it up in the Krebs cycle with exercise, because it's kind of a dead-end molecule. All right, so breakdown of fat into fatty acids and glycerol, that's just a nice hydrolysis reaction. The enzyme that's necessary is called lipase, and it produces acetyl-CoAs. How many carbons are in this acetyl group right here? There's only two, okay? And those acetyl groups can be donated to the Krebs cycle. So the last reaction that I want you to know in this chapter is what we call beta oxidation. Okay, and beta oxidation is just the step for breaking a fatty acid down. And we said, how is a fatty acid broken down in terms of carbon fragments? Two carbons at a time, and then the next two, and then the next two. All right, so let's just kind of see how that happens. So here we have a nice long fatty acid. Here's the carboxyl group. Here's the alpha and beta carbons, right? And don't forget, this fatty acid right here, is this really long or short chain? It's a really long chain, right? You kind of memorized that diagram for the first test already. All right, so to get a fatty acid started, we need an ATP. We need coenzyme A. So that activates this group. So we spend one ATP. So now it's bound to coenzyme A, and it goes through another rearrangement of the chemical bonds over here, and in so doing, some of that energy is used to produce FADH2. And is that a good thing for your body? Yeah, because that can donate high-energy electrons to ETC to generate ATP. And in my way of thinking, how many ATPs? Yeah, two. All right, so your book says 1.5, right? That's taking into consider some losses in metabolism. Beta oxidation takes place in mitochondria. So fatty acids are metabolized by beta oxidation in mitochondria. Under what kind of conditions? Under oxidative conditions, under aerobic conditions. So oxygen is necessary for beta oxidation. I guess that kind of says it in the name right here. All right, then there's some other rearrangements that take place. I don't see any major transfers of energy. But then finally, these last two carbons are broken off, and they're going to be carried to the Krebs cycle by coenzyme A. That's a coenzyme. And in so doing, when this bond is broken, two more NADHs are produced, which is good because your body can make, what, 3 ATP by donating those high-energy electrons to ETC. And then, of course, this acetyl group can be donated to the Krebs cycle, and that you can just add up all the ATPs that's produced by one turn of the Krebs cycle. So now you have a long fatty acid chain, and it can be recycled, and another 2-carbon fragment can be broken off, right? And then another 2-carbon fragment can be broken off. So for every 2-carbon fragment, right, we can generate, at least in your books counting, 14 ATPs for every 2-carbon fragment. So that's why a tremendous amount of energy is stored in a fatty acid. And I want you to know that when fat is broken down, or what's the name of the reaction that breaks fatty acids down? Beta oxidation, right? And I think maybe you should know that it breaks it down in a how many carbon fragment? A 2-carbon fragment, and when you end up with that 2-carbon fragment, what's the fate of that 2-carbon fragment? Can it be used to make sugar? No, it's stuck, right? It can only be donated to the Krebs cycle to produce NADH, FADH2, and some ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. And the other thing I want you to know is, where does beta oxidation take place? Mitochondria, that's right, inside mitochondria. All right, so I think that's it for this particular chapter. Any questions at all? Okay, so maybe you see me during some office hours or something. But I think if you were to follow this discussion on the board at the very beginning, I think that's going to be really helpful for you to organize in your mind cellular respiration. Okay. And here is the sign-in sheet. Right here, thank you. Okay, so next chapter is 7. 7 is a really, really long chapter, and I noticed that we do have a test scheduled a week from Monday. And I can't imagine that we're going to be able to finish chapter 9 before that test. So I think if we're really speedy, we're going to be able to finish chapter 7, all right, but not chapter 9. But stay tuned. That's the way I'm thinking right at the moment. Okay. All right, so let's move into chapter 7. A lot of chapter 7 is a review for you guys. I do want to say a couple things. All right, so we have nervous tissue. What kinds of cells make up nervous tissue? How many different kinds of cells make up nervous tissue? What can you remember from anatomy? Two kinds of cells. You've got neurons and support cells, which we call glial cells, or sometimes we call them neuroglia cells. All right, so you got the neurons, and the job of a neuron is to transmit electrical information very fast over long distances in your body, maybe from your brain all the way down to the tip of your toe, very, very fast, like the lightning bolt. Okay. The neuroglia, on the other hand, don't transmit information in terms of electrical information, but they support the job of the neuron. Right? They allow neurons to do their job properly. They protect. Sometimes they nourish a neuron. Sometimes they allow certain neurons to proliferate or grow. And neuroglia sometimes allow neurons to connect up together in just the right way so that they have the right kind of function. All right, so for years and years and years, people were only interested in neurons because those were the cells transmitting information. But recently we learned that neurons can't really operate without neuroglia performing their function, so now everybody's really interested in neuroglia because they're really the underlying factors of how the nervous system works. So we don't want to short our understanding of neuroglia. All right, so the nervous system probably can be broken down structurally into two main divisions, right? And you know, those two main divisions are the brain and spinal cord, otherwise known as the central nervous system, and then everything outside the central nervous system is the peripheral nervous system. All right, starting with cranial nerves and spinal nerves. Functionally, the nervous system can be broken down into maybe three kinds of neurons. Okay, so not just in terms of structure, but in terms of function. There are neurons that bring information into the central nervous system. Okay, what do we call those? Neurons that bring information into the central nervous system, like well, that's what I'm using right now. I see I still have some students in class. That's wonderful. I'm using what? Sensory neurons, right? Or what's another name for a sensory neuron? Afferent, right? So that's a functional classification. As opposed to sensory, what's another kind of neuron? Efferent or a motor neuron, which is taking information from the central nervous system out to the periphery. And then the third class are neurons that are located completely within the central nervous system. We call those interneurons. Those kinds of neurons are used for making decisions, for figuring out where information is coming from on the body, comparing information, and then making a decision on what to do with that information. All right, so we talked about the kinds of cells. You got neurons and glial cells right here. And you have many more glial cells than you do neurons. All right, so let's take a look at some neurons. They gather and transmit information by responding to stimuli. So they're receptive to various kinds of stimuli. Let me get my pointer working here. All right, and if it's a sufficient stimulus, then they can send some electrical chemical messages, impulses, which relate to this stimuli to the central nervous system. All right, and part of the way that they do that is by releasing chemical messengers between neurons. All right, and neuron that we see right here has three main parts to it. This part right here that contains the nucleus, we call this the cell body. Sometimes we call that the soma, right? The soma just means cell body. Sometimes we can also see other parts of a neuron right here by looking at these small projections. And these small projections are what we call dendrites. And then the third part of a neuron is this very long projection right here, and this is what we call an axon. So these are the three parts of a neuron. You got the cell body, you got the dendrite, and an axon. And information flows, electrical information flows in this neuron always from a dendrite to a cell body and then down an axon. So you should think of a neuron as a one-way street, and that's why when we think of neurons in the body by function, they're either efferent or afferent, but you never have a neuron that is both efferent and afferent at the same time because they can't operate that way. Information only flows in one direction. All right, so another way that you should think of a neuron is that the dendrite and cell body receives information, so this is the receiving part of a neuron, and that information then is sent down an axon. So the axon is the sending part of a neuron. So I'll say that one more time. The dendrite and cell body is the receiving part of a neuron, and the axon is the sending part. All right, you should also remember from anatomy that there are different kinds of neurons by their shape, which also helps determine what their function is. This kind of neuron that we see right here, right, is what we call a multipolar neuron. Multipolar because of all of these dendrites, as opposed to this neuron that we see in the B part of this figure right here. Anybody remember what this one is called? Okay, yeah, unipolar, sometimes called pseudo-unipolar. Here is just one projection coming out of the cell body, and then it bifurcates into these two processes right here. These are dendrites, right? So we call this the peripheral projection from this neuron, okay? And this is going to be in the peripheral process, in the peripheral nervous system, right? So these dendrites are receiving information, and then this is the axon as it goes into the central nervous system. So this is what we call the central process, because it's sending information into the central nervous system. All right, so that's a pseudo-unipolar neuron. And what kind of function does this pseudo-unipolar neuron perform in the body? I talked about it a lot just now, but what's one word that you could talk about receiving information in the periphery and sending it into the central nervous system? What kind of neuron by function does that? Afferent. That's an afferent neuron, right? And this multipolar neuron, the cell body is in the central nervous system and these axon terminals are in the peripheral nervous system, so this would be an example of a nice motor neuron or efferent neuron. Okay, so I do want you to know axon neurons by their shape and function as well. All right, so I think I talked about all this kind of stuff already. There's going to be one more class of neurons that we're going to talk about in this class, and that is the bipolar neuron. Maybe you can remember what a bipolar neuron looks like, and the function of a bipolar neuron is for special sense organs, like for vision, for instance, and hearing. Okay, I don't have a picture to show you what those look like. All right, so dendrites receive information, convey it to the cell body, because they have something that are called ligand-gated channels. Right, axons conduct impulses away from the cell body because they have a different kind of channel in the cell membrane. We call these voltage-gated channels. So these channels in the cell membrane are normally closed, but they can open up depending on a particular kind of stimulus. The proper kind of stimulus in a dendrite is going to be a signaling molecule. And a small signaling molecule is what we call a ligand because it's going to bind to a receptor that's on that particular channel. And when it binds to that receptor, the channel is going to open up. As opposed to the channels that are in the axon right here, we call those voltage-gated channels. They don't respond to signaling molecules, they just respond to changes in membrane potential. Right? Have you ever heard of membrane potential yet? I think we talked about that. The resting membrane potential will change. And then these channels right here will open or close depending on what the voltage is across the membrane. Because a voltage can act like a force, can twist and turn proteins, and can cause small conformation changes in a protein and open up a channel. All right, so another way of saying that the dendrites and cell body is the receiving part of the neuron is because they have ligand-gated channels. Axons are the sending part of a neuron because they have voltage-gated channels. All right, so you're going to have to hear me say that a number of times before I'm sure you're comfortable with that. And we're going to look at those properties pretty extensively in this chapter. All right, so let's before we get into the electrical properties, let's talk about some other ways that neurons can transmit molecules around down an axon. All right, so don't forget, the axon is that long length, and it requires two special transport mechanisms. Axoplasmic flow is one, and axonal transport is another one. Axoplasmic flow moves soluble compounds, things that are dissolved in solution, toward the nerve endings, kind of like peristalsis. So an axon can actually squish material down to the axon terminus, right, just by deformations in the plasma membrane. That's relatively slow. Okay. Axonal transport, on the other hand, moves large molecules, maybe some organelles and maybe even vesicles, and insoluble compounds in either direction, all right, along like a monorail system. What did we call the monorail system inside of a cell? Those microtubules, all right? So there are microtubules that help give the shape its particular, the cell its particular shape and form, but those microtubules is a transportation system within inside the cell. And materials can move in a bidirectional way. It can move from the cell body down to the axon terminus, or materials can move from the axon terminus back up to the cell body. So whenever we say anterograde, we mean in the forward direction. And we're going to define that as away from the cell body down to the axon terminus. All right, that's the anterograde direction. And it's going to require a microtubule, but a special little protein, that, and it's a motor protein. We call this a kinesin. So kinesins are used to move things from the cell body down to the axon terminus. That's the forward direction. Right, the backward or reverse direction, which would be from the axon terminus back up toward the cell body, we're going to call that retrograde transport. All right, so I want to use these two terms exclusively in this class. I don't want to say going in the backward direction or the forward direction. I actually want to use what? Anterograde and retrograde. Probably you've heard of retrograde before. I'm not so sure you've heard of anterograde. Now, the retrograde transport uses a different kind of motor protein that we call a dynein. All right, so but they still require microtubules. So there are two different kinds of motor proteins depending on which way these materials are going to move along the axon. All right, and even some viruses and toxins can have access to the cell body once they infect an axon terminus by using these dynein molecules. They figured out a way to take over the rapid transport system of the cell. Okay, so we've talked about this already. Here we have the central nervous system versus peripheral nervous system, and here we see a number of neurons that are actually spanning these two. Okay, so here is a nice sensory neuron, or a unipolar. Here is a nice motor neuron, where the cell body is in the central nervous system. All right, and what you don't see on this slide, what don't you see on this illustration right here? But it's listed. Interneurons, right, or association neurons, which are located completely within the central nervous system. All right, so don't forget, what are the two main structural parts of the central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord, and here is spinal cord right here. So there are going to be interneurons that are located completely within the spinal cord. So here are the three shapes of neurons, right? You got the unipolar, the bipolar, and multipolar. And just make sure you know the functions of these neurons as well. Okay? All right, so those are pretty easy to see. All right, so let's turn our attention from neurons to the glial cells in particular. And here I see a neuron in this gold color and in this like beige color right here. How do I do? Thumbs up or down? Okay. Are some support cells. And this is a nice, what's the function of this neuron right here? Okay, it's a multipolar. What's a good function of a multipolar neuron? Okay, we're going to see these as used as interneurons in the central nervous system, all right, or as motor neurons, where the cell body is in the CNS and the axon is going into the peripheral nervous system. And these particular cells right here are called Schwann cells. You're kind of familiar with them from anatomy. They wrap themselves around an axon, and they make a chemical compound called myelin, which is a lipid, and that lipid, what can you tell me about polar compounds and lipids? Do they mix very well? Or electrical ions like sodium and potassium, will they dissolve in lipid? No, because lipid is hydrophobic, and all those other compounds are polar or hydrophilic. So myelin excludes ions, and it acts as insulation. It will prevent ions from entering or leaving this axon. And when an ion moves, that's really an electrical current because it has an electrical charge. An electrical charge in motion is an electrical current, so it prevents electrical currents across the cell membrane. So it acts like insulation. What are most of the wires in your house like? Are they insulated or non-insulated? Oh, that's for sure. They're insulated, right? Because when you unplug your toaster, you don't want to get electrocuted, right? So these cells right here, these Schwann cells, lay down insulation, layer upon layer of insulation. And this outer layer right here is the part of a Schwann cell that contains the cytoplasm. So sometimes we call that anybody know what that area right here, this outermost layer? That's not labeled on this slide right here. But here's the nucleus and the rest of the cytoplasm. We call that the neurolemma. Right, so that's the neurolemma. And these layers right here are that's the myelin sheath that acts as insulation. Now notice that the whole axon is not continuously covered with these Schwann cells, but there's a gap between them. And we call that the node of Ranvier. So there can be currents, right, that can enter or leave the cell at these particular junctions right here. Right, and we're going to see what the importance of these nodes of Ranvier are pretty soon. So the Schwann cells wrap insulation around axons in the peripheral nervous system. That's where we find them. The other kind of cell that we see in the peripheral nervous system are what we call satellite cells. And I don't think I have a picture of a satellite cell anywhere. No, I sure don't. But they're just going to be surrounding the cell body and these dendrites. And they just help this neuron do its particular job. All right, so this is just a picture of how a Schwann cell wraps itself around. Oh, here's neurolemma. Right, there's the neurolemma. All right, so the other place where we find support cells is not only the peripheral nervous system, but also in the central nervous system. So these cell types we see in the brain and spinal cord. So again, this nice yellow right here is a neuron. And what kind of neurons do these look like right here? Multipolar, right? So these could be association neurons or a motor neuron where this axon is going to leave the spinal cord or cranial nerve. And we can see some cells that are wrapping myelin around an axon. But these we don't call Schwann cells. They have a different structure, and they're located in the CNS, not PNS. So these are called oligodendrocytes. Their function is pretty much the same, right? They insulate these axons. And we're going to talk about what that actually does for the cell. All right, microglia kind of look like a little star. And, these are really, really small. These are almost like white blood cells. Can anybody think of what a function of a white blood cell might be that's in your circulatory system? It's for fighting infection. It's an immune cell. So these microglia cells are immunological cells. They're crawling around inside your brain all the time looking for things that don't belong there, like what? Fungi, bacteria, viruses, maybe even tumor cells. All right, and then their job is to phagocytize them and destroy those cells, and then you don't get any encephalitis or tumor. All right, so that's their function. All right, so that's oligodendrocyte, microglia cell, tumor cells that we're going to be interested in. This astrocyte right here. Now, this astrocyte kind of looks like a star with a bunch of rays coming out of it, and that's how it got its name. All right, and we see that it has a number of processes. Some of the processes go over and touch a capillary right here. What's the function of a capillary? Exchange, right? Because it's got a really thin membrane. All right, so the astrocyte attaches itself to this capillary. So you might think, well, it might either aid in the exchange of material from the brain or impede the flow of material. And indeed, its function is both of those. So it has one process. It has a perivascular foot on the capillary, right? And then that's connected to the cell body. And then there's another process that connects to the neuron. So this is like a special delivery system for certain metabolites that this cell needs. And of course, neurons are very, very active. What's an important metabolite that this cell body needs to make ATP? Glucose, for instance. So an astrocyte can act as a special delivery system, taking glucose from the blood and delivering it directly to this neuron, providing energy for it. That's an important function of an astrocyte. Another important function of the astrocyte is that there are a number of times, well, daily, right, and repetitively, when we eat various kinds of foods, there are toxins in the food. And if those toxins were able to get into the central nervous system, right, then we would lose our brains. We would lose the functioning power of the brain. So these astrocytes form a barrier to those compounds. So what we see right here is just a partial barrier, but there is a barrier called the blood-brain barrier that is special, that protects the brain from many kinds of compounds that are in the blood. All right. And as a matter of fact, a lot of times when a pharmaceutical company is interested in producing a drug that we want to work in the brain, they have to figure out a way to get across this blood-brain barrier. They have to structurally modify that particular compound so that it can actually move across the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain. All right, so that's another kind of cell. We're going to talk about some other functions of the astrocyte in just a little bit. And then the fourth cell are these ependymal cells right here. Okay, and if you think of the central nervous system, remember that it has a space inside of it filled with cerebrospinal fluid. What do we call that space filled with cerebrospinal fluid? Okay, like the ventricles of the brain, right? The lateral ventricles, third ventricle, fourth ventricle, and even what the subarachnoid space is filled with cerebrospinal fluid, and the central canal in the spinal cord is filled with cerebrospinal fluid. Well, there is a lining. There's like an epithelium that lines all those spaces that separates cerebrospinal fluid from the rest of the brain so that it acts as a protection. So again, if there's an infection of the cerebrospinal fluid, it doesn't infect these neurons directly, right? So that's just an added layer of protection. These are what we call ependymal cells. Ependymal cells sometimes regulate the composition of ions in the extracellular space of the brain, but they can also act as stem cells, we believe, to make neurons under certain conditions, maybe when certain neurons are damaged or when somebody is using their brain really, really hard and you need more neurons to accomplish those tasks. Like, what would be a good condition? Like, what would be an example of a condition where all of a sudden you start using your brain and you need a lot more neurons? Like maybe when you take a physiology class, okay? All right, so that's kind of interesting because we have said before that, okay, if you have a certain structure, if you have a molecule that has a certain structure and you change the structure of that molecule, what else happens? Yeah, the function. And you know what? You can use that same analogy to explain why muscles hypertrophy, why they get bigger, right? Because when you change the function of that muscle, you exercise it, it gets what? Bigger and stronger. When you have a bone and you stress it and use it, how does it respond? Yeah, it gets bigger and stronger too. That helps protect people from osteoporosis. And when you stress your brain, guess what happens to it? It gets bigger and stronger too. Okay, just like muscles and bones, neurons make new connections between each other, and maybe we even build more neurons out of these stem cells in this ependymal lining right here. So it is true, it's been shown by many studies, not particular to this class or physiology class in general, but that your brain is very plastic. That means that it does change its structure when you use it. And you get smarter when you use your brain. All right, there's a corollary to that too. And that is, what does the brain like to do? What's the one function of a brain that it likes to do more than anything else? You probably haven't thought of this, okay? But it likes to, I mean, if you've had little kids at home, what are they asking you all the time? Why? Brains love to learn, okay? And I didn't hear any groans. That's really, really nice. Because you're probably thinking you're learning a lot in here. But brains like to learn more than any other kind of function. And sometimes it's beneficial and sometimes it's very harmful for the brain. And I'll try to tell you some circumstances where that's really harmful for a brain to learn inappropriate behaviors. Oh, I guess I should tell you right now, because I can't remember a good place in the class. But, for instance, there is a behavior that brains do sometimes that's very pathological, and we need to prevent. We don't want brains to learn this particular behavior, but have you ever heard of epilepsy? Oh, absolutely. One of the most dangerous things about epilepsy is that when somebody has an epileptic seizure, guess what their brain does? It learns how to produce that seizure. Okay, and so the way to treat epilepsy is to be very aggressive with it so that the brain doesn't learn how to produce those seizures over and over and over again. Okay, so that's just one example. Okay, so can you remember all these different kinds of cells right here? Oligodendrocytes, microglia, where do you find these? Central nervous system, right. All right, so a big difference between an oligodendrocyte and a Schwann cell is that an oligodendrocyte not only can lay a myelin sheath down on one axon, but what? Many axons within the central nervous system. Okay, and every once in a while, somebody's immune system recognizes that myelin or a particular form of myelin in one part of the brain as being a foreign cell. All right, so what does your immune system do if it recognizes a foreign cell in your body? All right, this little microglia cell says, ah, that cell doesn't belong there, and attacks the oligodendrocyte, and it strips the myelin sheath from this axon in the central nervous system, and it destroys the function of these neurons right here. Anybody know what disease process that's called? That's called multiple sclerosis, right? So multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease. It might be precipitated by maybe some kind of infectious reaction initially. We're not exactly sure. But that's when somebody's own immune system attacks these oligodendrocytes. And we're going to look a little bit more particular what the function of these oligodendrocytes are in just a little bit. Okay, let's talk a little bit about axonal regeneration. We're all pretty interested in this, especially in terms of repairing the central nervous system, like, for instance, spinal cord injuries, right? Axon regeneration after a cut or a crushing injury or whatever occurs much more readily in the peripheral nervous system than in the central nervous system. These two nervous systems work pretty much in opposite ways. Because oligodendrocytes, where do we find oligodendrocytes once again? Central nervous system produce proteins that inhibit regrowth, right? So they form just a glial scar that blocks the regrowth of an axon in the central nervous system. So these oligodendrocytes are much more concerned with what? Controlling overproliferation of neurons within the brain, because you just don't want a mass of neurons in the brain. You need them to connect up properly. So oligodendrocytes really temper the activity of production of axons. But in the peripheral nervous system, there are no oligodendrocytes. What's the companion cell or the cell that's analogous to an oligodendrocyte in the... it's the Schwann cell. All right, so here we see nice Schwann cells, so you know peripheral nervous system. When a nerve is cut, all right, this debris, of course, is all removed by phagocytosis. And then the remnants of these Schwann cells form what we call a neural tube, or a regeneration tube. And the Schwann cells secrete a chemical which stimulates the growth of an axon back down to its particular target tissue. So Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system enhance the regrowth, but oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system block regrowth and actually just forms a scar tissue in that area. All right, so two other things. So the kinds of chemicals that are used by glial cells to promote growth, regeneration, and maybe even the formation of new neurons in the brain are called neurotrophins. So neurotrophins are important to promote fetal nerve growth, right? And they're even required in the adult brain to maintain neurons, right? And they're important for regeneration. And we've kind of learned a lot about neurotrophins lately because there is a condition, right, called clinical depression, and we now understand that these neurotrophins aren't being secreted properly, and the somebody with clinical depression can't respond very well to stressful circumstances because their brains are kind of just locked in, kind of like a deep freeze. They can't respond to everyday circumstances. All right, so the cells that secrete neurotrophins are these astrocytes right here. So astrocytes are very important, and so now you should probably link up astrocytes to some important disease processes, like, for instance, clinical depression. So what can an astrocyte do? Well, we see that it can bring in glucose. It can adjust levels of electrolytes in the extracellular fluid right here. It can release neurotrophins that regulate neurogenesis. And when we have a neuron, here's an axon terminus from one neuron. It wants to pass information to a next neuron. So maybe let's just say this is an interneuron right here, and this is a dendrite on a motor neuron, which is going to carry that information to the periphery. Right? There's a space between these two neurons that we call, what do we call this space? Yeah, that's the synapse. And in particular, this is a nice chemical synapse. And that chemical, which we call a neurotransmitter, can be recycled sometimes by this astrocyte. So astrocytes can be used to regulate levels of neurotransmitters within a synapse. So that's another important function of an astrocyte. And I've talked about the blood-brain barrier already in terms of astrocytes. All right, so we're good with the different kinds of cell shapes and their functions, both neurons and neuroglia. So now let's start talking about some electrical properties of these cells of the nervous system, and you get to pick which cells those are. Are those glial cells or neurons? Okay, and? Good, I'm glad. Otherwise you wouldn't need to take this class. We're going to be interested in the electrical properties of neurons. Okay, so we're interested in looking at the membrane potentials of neurons, because neurons transmit electrical impulses, right, very rapidly over long distances of the body. That's what their job is. Okay. All right, so at rest, even neuroglia cells, but especially neurons, right, have a resting membrane potential. They're acting like a battery. They're negative where? On the inside of the cell, and positive on the outside. So you got to change your notes. There's an error on this slide. Can anybody tell me where the big glaring error is on this slide right here? The membrane potential results from what? What's trapped inside the cell? Anions, large proteins that have mostly a negative charge on them, right? They're trapped inside the cell, not cations. And of course, what else helps generate that resting membrane potential? Well, that sodium-potassium pump is electrogenic. All right, so that keeps sodium high on the outside, keeps potassium high on the inside. And there are leak channels that allow potassium to enter the cell. So there are channels that are pretty much open all the time that allow potassium to enter the cell, because they're attracted by what? These large anions that are inside the cell, right? And so what does that produce? That produces a resting membrane potential of about minus 70 millivolts. Maybe you had to know that for the first test. All right, so a characteristic of a neuron is that it's excitable. All right, they can discharge their resting membrane potential quickly by rapid changes in permeability to various ions. So, I don't know, what kind of ions might we be talking about? Sodium and potassium, okay? And in a cell at rest, there are membrane channels for sodium, but they're closed. So sodium can't go across the cell membrane when it's at rest, all right? But neurons are excitable, so those channels can change. They can open up and allow sodium to either enter or leave the cell. All right, so neurons and muscles do this to generate and conduct electrical impulses. So this statement right here kind of says that neurons and muscles share a similar characteristic, right? They manipulate sodium and potassium currents to transmit electrical impulses along their whole length. But what's a big difference between a neuron and a muscle? What separates muscle from a neuron? And you know this, but you're ready for the weekend. A muscle does what when it's excited? It contracts, right? And a neuron does not, right? It just transmits that electrical impulse. All right, well, let's define a couple things before we're ready for the weekend. Okay, so here we have a nice neuron. Oh, what kind of neuron does that look like? It looks like a multipolar neuron shot with a nice fisheye lens, right? There's a really big axon terminus right here. And we got a couple of electrodes. We got a voltmeter. And we put one electrode inside the cell and another on the outside so we can measure the voltage across the plasma membrane. And instead of just reading a number, we're going to display it on an oscilloscope, which is like a TV screen. And the deflection, the vertical deflection of a light beam represents the voltage, and here is the scale of that voltage. So zero voltage is right at this line right here, okay, just measured across these two terminals, and then negative voltage is below it, positive voltage is above, and the voltage scale is kind of small. It's millivolts, but it's, 1,000 millivolts is 1 volt, so it's not really all that small. It's pretty easy to measure. So when the cell's at rest, we say that its resting membrane potential is at what, RMP, which is how many millivolts? Yeah, minus 70 millivolts, okay. But it can change. If it's going to remain at rest, the voltage is not going to change, but that voltage can change. If it drifts up to zero, it becomes less negative, right? The voltage is going away from minus 70 finally to zero. We call that depolarization. Right, so that's depolarization when RMP does what? It disappears, goes to zero. Right, that is what we call a stimulation event that's stimulating this particular cell. Right, the voltage not only can go to zero, but it can go the opposite way. It can become more negative. Right, it's getting farther and farther away from zero. We call that hyperpolarization. And that is what we're going to call an inhibition. So stimulus is when we depolarize. Hyperpolarize is going to inhibit this neuron. The last concept that we're going to see on this particular slide is that after a neuron is stimulated by what kind of process? Depolarization. It's going to return to its resting membrane potential. You don't see it on the oscilloscope right here, but we have the definition. We're going to call that repolarization, so that when the membrane potential goes from, say, 0 to minus 70 to where it's at rest, that's what we call repolarization. All right, so we're going to look at various ion currents that account for these kinds of processes. All right, well, I tell you what, let's maybe think of a particular case. Let's just say we have a neuron that's at RMP, minus 70 millivolts. All right, that means on the inside we have more positive charges or negative charges at RMP on the inside of the cell? Negative charges, okay? Now let's think of an ion that's at a high concentration outside the cell compared to inside. You had to memorize that. Somebody said sodium. So you have high sodium outside the cell, low inside. What's the charge of sodium? It's positive, okay? And the inside is negative, so what does sodium want to do? Does it want to enter that cell, and why? That was a test question. It wants to enter the cell, why? Because opposite charges attract, right? It's negative on the inside. That electrical attraction is going to pull sodium inside the cell. But what else is going to draw sodium inside the cell? Concentration gradient, right? So if we open up a channel for sodium, guess what it's going to do? It's going to rush inside the cell, and when sodium enters the cell, what happens to the resting membrane potential? It, and the correct word is what? It depolarizes. And what is that called? That is a stimulus to that particular cell, right? So depolarization is due to one ion, at least in our initial considerations right here, that is sodium. When sodium enters the cell, it's going to depolarize the cell, and that's going to stimulate the cell. Okay. So that's something good to look at right now. All right, so membrane channels will regulate the flow of ions in and out of the cell. And we just showed you how, or you just thought about how important it was to regulate sodium. Okay, there are two different ways that ions can enter or leave a cell, right, and produce membrane potential changes. All right, so membrane potential changes occur by flow of ions through membrane channels. And why is that so? Why can't an ion just move across the plasma membrane? Because an ion is a polar compound, and only nonpolar compounds can go across a plasma membrane. So that's pretty special. All right, some channels are normally open, and some are normally closed. The ones that are normally open, for instance, are these potassium leakage channels. They're usually open. But many more channels are closed all the time. They have molecular gates that can be opened or closed depending on various circumstances. All right, so some of the circumstances that can open up a channel have to do with voltage. And we call those voltage-gated channels. So when the membrane potential changes, these particular gates open up. All right, so voltage-gated potassium channels are closed in resting cells, and even sodium channels, which are voltage-gated, are closed in resting cells. So here's an illustration of what a channel looks like. So here we see the nice phospholipid bilayer. And this cell is at rest. So we have minus 70 millivolts on the inside compared to the outside. We have high sodium out here, low sodium here. And can sodium go across the membrane with this protein in this configuration right here? It can't, right? It's excluded, because this protein channel is closed. All right, but if the cell is stimulated, right, the voltage changes across the membrane due to depolarization. That's maybe starting, well, we're going to talk about an action potential a little bit. And as the voltage changes across the membrane, that's going to pull and push on this protein. And that's kind of like poking you in the side. What's going to happen to that protein? It's going to change shape, conformation. When it changes shape, now the function of it changes, so instead of preventing the entry of sodium, it allows the entry of sodium. And you can think, oh, well, that's even going to stimulate the cell even more, right? That's going to make the inside of the cell more positive or less negative. All right, but the sodium channel has a special little appendage to it right here that after it opens up, after a short period of time, and again, depending on the voltage, this little extra side chain right here can now bend and insert itself right into the channel. And even though the channel is open, it is now plugged. All right, so this is what we call an inactivation gate. So even though the protein channel is open, it becomes inactivated because of this special little gate right here. And this is going to produce something that we call a refractory period. All right, so I think I'm going to stop right here. And just like in that last chapter, the cellular respiration chapter, where you know I had to give a number of lectures before you had a pretty clear understanding of what's going on, the same thing for this particular chapter. All right, it's going to take a little bit of discussion and then go back and study it and make a little more progress, go back and study it, and then it's going to make some sense. So we're talking about some really small pieces right here. All right, so that's it for lecture today.